A new poll says voters here in Duval County are willing to pay more for good schools. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9. Now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, too. And just ahead, we'll take your calls on taxes for public education. Find out why voters in this area say yes to that. 549-2937. Also ahead, who has the hot hand in Florida politics? We'll tell you about the new Influence 100 list out this week. Plus, author Jennifer Swanson and the service dogs of Project Chance helping First Coast kids with autism. All of that ahead. But first this hour, a new poll with compelling results here in Duval County. As most voters here say, they are willing to raise taxes to pay for supporting our public schools. That, according to the Jacksonville Public Education Fund, they commissioned this poll. Fund President Trey Czar says the numbers prove that strong support for school funding does exist in this area. And there's more data to share. Trey Czar here in studio now to tell us more about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. And what are your questions about this new poll on behalf of the Jacksonville Public Education Fund? What are your thoughts about raising taxes, not by much, but by some, to improve public schools? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so you selected adults around Duval County and asked them what they thought about education and found the majority say they would support a tax increase for schools.
Yeah, we've done this poll now three times for the past 3 years in a row. It's a telephone poll, just like you would poll presidential about presidential preferences, and ask a whole series of questions, one of which is around the question of taxation, and saw 7 in 10 adults in Duval County that said they would support a tax increase this year. We've seen that's consistent with what we've seen over the past couple of years. We've consistently seen 60 to 70% support.
And it's gone up over the years, hasn't it? There's been an increase.
It has. And we see majorities across all demographic groups, all political identification groups. So it's a really it's a really strong finding for sure.
Why do you think the numbers have ticked upward over the years?
Well, this last year, we think that all the conversations happened in St. Johns County has had an impact. They went out for a sales tax referendum for their schools in part very recently. And so that, I think, has influenced the conversation here in Duval County. And then we'd like to think, we don't have a ton of strong evidence, but that the rest of the poll shows continuing confidence in the improvement of the public school system here in Duval County. And we hope that some of that is rubbing off on this taxation question as well.
And as a new poll shows, the majority of Duval County voters say they're in favor of a slight tax increase for public schools. We need to know where you stand on that. Give us a call, 549-2937. Superintendent Nicolai Vitti is talking about this as well, Trey. He has tried to float the idea of raising taxes or floating a bond issue for the schools. He says that's been tough to sell. He's pointed out we have the oldest set of school buildings in Florida, in Duval County.
Yeah, the state grew from north to south, and so being in the northern edge of the state, we do have the oldest buildings in the state of Florida. So this is a challenge that we're going to have to address as a community in the coming years.
What else did the poll find?
We looked at a lot of things. I think one of the biggest surprises to us, for the first time, we asked the community to estimate the graduation rate, and the average estimate was 61%, which is significantly lower than the actual graduation rate of 74%. And so we look back, and the public's perception of the quality of the public school system is really 3 or 4 years back, and so we know that public opinion trails reality and across a wide variety of topic areas, and this is one of those. And so we think there's a huge opportunity just for the district and the community to talk about what's really happening.
Children or parents with children in the public schools are much more likely to have a positive opinion of the Duval County public schools, obviously.
Absolutely. It's sort of like, you know, everybody loves their congressman but hates Congress. It's the same sort of idea. Those who are the closest to the system feel the best about it.
But in Duval County, don't we have the highest percentage of parents who have their children in private schools, charter schools, or homeschools?
We have a large percentage of non-traditional district schools. And what's interesting is that the district population has been relatively steady, slight decreases over the past 5 or 6 years. The private school population has seen the same slight decreases over the past 5 or 6 years, but the charter school population and the homeschool population have continued to grow significantly.
And if you're just tuning in as we speak to the Jacksonville Public Education President Trey Czar about this new poll. What are your questions about schools in your neighborhood? What are your thoughts about raising your taxes to fund public education? Do your kids go to public school? Do they not? Let us know what you think. Give us a call at 549-2937. You also talk a little bit about the grading system for schools and standardized testing. That has really come under scrutiny in recent years and controversy. 50% of the public says they still want the state of Florida to publicize letter grades for schools. Only half the public now is still buying into this A through F system that former Governor Jeb Bush first put forth, letting people know this is an A school, this is a B school, that we never used to have that for schools.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We've asked people for the past 3 years, what are the factors that they would use to evaluate the quality of a school? And consistently, test scores and school grades have been at the top of that list. They remain at the top of that list. But the percentage of people who tell us they use that has dropped significantly over the past 12 months. And we attribute a lot of that to the consternation that has really existed in the public discourse around school grades and around test scores and testing in general.
Anything jump out in the survey results to you that was surprising?
I think this perception gap was very surprising. The community continues to see the system improving, but their perceptions are not keeping up as quickly as those improvements are happening. We continue to see a large percentage of the population that says the system is performing at a fair rate. Continue to see folks really looking, as I said earlier, back at a lower graduation rate, and we see that when we talk to people throughout the community. When folks move to town, the first conversation they often have if they have children is, "Well, where are you going to put your kids?" "Well, I'm going to move out of county," and that's a real concern. It's a societal perception more than it is a reality.
Right, because as the poll finds, people still assume that the graduation rate is far lower than it actually is. The graduation rate is now up to about 75% in Duval County. And as we discuss this new survey, we want your calls. When it comes to the Duval County Public Schools, what's on your mind? Give us a call right now, 549-2937. Haley is on the north side. Hello, Haley.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have actually two school-age children. One is in kindergarten, north side at New Berlin Elementary, and with all of the new development that's going on the north side, families moving here, we're a military family, and I know there are quite a few other military families, and just people moving here with all the new housing development, the schools are very, very, very overcrowded. There are over 1,200 kids at New Berlin, and I know that's way over where it's supposed to be, and they're supposed to accept them like they should. But what is going to be done about the continuous development here? Why aren't we considering new schools? The classroom sizes are huge. Recesses, physical education is being diminished in order to compensate and stay on track with academic goals. So what's going to be done about the north side and all the growth there? Thank you.
Haley, thanks for that question.
Yeah, and we continue to see growth in different areas in our community. Certainly the far north side is an area where we continue to see a lot of population growth, as well as the far southeast edges of Duval County. And those are areas where new schools are really necessary. And the challenge right now is, as state funding for capital needs has declined, we've got to figure out a way to address that as a community. And so I think Haley's points are completely valid of needing to start that community conversation about what do we do, not only about existing buildings that are older than they should be and are starting to become maintenance challenges, but equally as importantly, what do we do in areas where there is high growth?
St. Johns County said yes to more taxes for that very problem. In Duval County, it looks as though the voters would say yes for the same reason.
Yeah, we see strong support for this concept. This was one of 40 questions in the poll, so I don't want to blow it out of proportion. We didn't ask specifics. We asked generally, would community members support a small increase in taxes for public schools? And the answer was yes. So I think there's a lot more discussion yet to be had before we get to a place where something's on a ballot.
549-2937. Let's go now to Hancock in San Marco. Hello, Hancock.
Good morning. Thank you very much for your time.
Sure.
Congratulations on your national debut in a few days.
Oh, thank you.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to co-op the issue for just a second, but I think there's a relevant point. They're spending hours and hours and tons of money discussing human rights ordinance in Jacksonville and whether or not LGBT are equal. And so I just think we could move on and discuss great issues like, yes, I would pay more tax to be considered equal in a moment. So we could move on and talk about prosperity. Budgets wait, progress wait, prosperity wait. All these resources on talking about whether or not I'm a human being. So, sir, I hope you can convince the public that this is the right way to go. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. And let's go to a few of your tweets and Facebook comments about this. Here's one from Jim. I will support a local tax hike for schools on the condition that the state stop giving money to private charters. Did that come up at all in the data, that whole issue?
It didn't. And I'd be curious to learn more from Jim about what he means by private charters. Charters are public schools. There's certainly tax credit scholarships, which is tax dollars or that go to private schools. So I think there may be there's something interesting there in his manner. But right now, charter schools have many of the same capital challenges that traditional mm-hmm. district public schools have.
There's a perception that charters aren't held to the same standards, though, educationally, some of them.
Yeah.
And that they don't, that the district schools don't always... That the playing field perhaps isn't level.
Yeah, and then there's certainly areas where it could come a little bit closer. But charter schools do have to take the same. Charter school students have to take the same Florida Standards Assessment testing, formerly the FCAT. They have to teach to the same standards, the new Florida standards. So there's a lot of similarity there. Where you start to get more differences when you look at private schools who are accepting what are called tax credit scholarships.
Here's another tweet. Any ideas on how to help the gifted programs in DCPS? One-day-a-week pull-out programs available at most elementary schools don't adequately address needs.
Yeah, and special education is a gigantic need, and gifted and talented education falls under there. And one thing the district has done, not only in Duval County, but districts across the state of Florida, is they have borrowed from their capital budgets that are usually used to build and repair buildings and devoted some of that money during the economic downturn to operating budgets, and that's the money that's used to fund everyday instruction. And so that's an area where we need to have some more discussions as well.
Let's go now to Stephen in Arlington. Hello, Stephen. Go ahead, Stephen. All right, Stephen, give us a call back. Gail is also in Arlington. Hi, Gail. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Go ahead.
I have been a teacher. I have also been a teacher trainer. And I would be willing, certainly, to vote for increased public education. My son graduated from Douglas Anderson. I'm a big fan of public education, but I would not support it as long as any money is allocated to charter schools. They tend to treat the teachers very poorly. I've taught at two of them. I was not impressed with the way the teaching was happening. Way too much time spent on computer software, trying to teacher-proof teachers at least two of the schools or charter schools that I have taught at.
Thank you for that. Trezor.
Yeah. One of the questions we've asked every year has been, I think, is related to this, which is we ask the community, which of the four planks in the district's strategic plan has the district made the most improvement in? And second in that list this year was recruiting, developing, and retaining great teachers and leaders. And it showed the highest increase year over year. So that's an area certainly where the district's devoted a ton of energy. The philanthropic sector's devoted a ton of resources. And we're starting to see those efforts play out in the priority list. The top area was around improving communication with parents and community members.
Gail in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Gail.
Yes. I'm very glad that St. Johns County just voted in support of more money for public schools, and also glad to hear that the Duval County citizens sound like they would support it as well. But I do think that it's important for our local governments to require the developers of these large new developments to actually pay for the schools that are going to be needed as a result of these new residential developments. And I think that we've lost a lot of the emphasis on that with the loss of the sort of central planning and the community planning, and I hope that we could return or increase the developers' contribution towards the school systems. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Lots of interesting comments.
Absolutely,
Trey.
And that's a great issue. You know, down in southeast Duval County in the Nocatee development, a good portion of that development is in Duval County, and they and the developers of that property have actually reserved land for a school. That school has yet to been built. It's not planned as of now, but I think those are the types of discussions that need to be had as we look at gigantic new housing developments, because it does impact the existing local school system.
And we have Stephen back in Arlington. Hello, Stephen. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is similar to the one that was just asked. I thought years ago, I lived near the Monument San Pablo area, and it seems like I heard a rumor, I guess, that the developers were supposedly been denied permits to build developments where the schools could not accommodate additional families. Was that not true?
I don't know anything about that, but I think, you know, again, I think this issue of as we plan for additional residential units in new areas of town, that we need to include schools in that discussion as we do fire stations and police stations and everything else.
West in Jacksonville. West, is that you?
It's me.
Hi, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually living in Fernandina, but I had a wonderful opportunity to go to Douglas Anderson School of Arts in Duval, and I just wanted to kind of ask a question and pose the idea of, you know, kind of what's happening with our arts and our extracurricular activities for students. That certainly benefited me. And, you know, are we looking at kind of reinstituting that? I know that for some time we've been teaching to a test so much that we've really kind of lost the soul of education, really what it's about. And my question is, is there anything that we're looking at doing to ensure that we're going to have funding for our arts programs, music and dance and, you know, whatever we can? And the other issue is are we going to provide our students who are struggling with opportunities for tutoring, you know, really give them an opportunity to get a leg up, especially if they're behind, especially if they're struggling in reading or mathematics. Those things are definitely important. And I will say, and I'll end with this, I'm really glad to see that we're kind of stepping back from teaching to these standards, because, like I said, you know, the teachers that I talked to and a lot of them friends over the years, is that it's really, it really hurts education to have to strip your lesson plan out and just try and teach to a test. So, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, the Duval County School Board's had a longstanding commitment to preserving arts funding, even in the midst of significant economic downturns. A few years ago, the district made a decision to put in arts, music, and PE teachers in every elementary school, which has been great. And the community has come to the table through an effort called Any Given Child, which is really looking at how do we continue to expand arts programming throughout the curriculum, but particularly at middle school, where there's a bit of a gap now. You know, shameless plug, there's also the district and number of community partners are also running an instrument donation program right now. I would encourage anyone who has extra instruments floating around in closets or under beds to please drop those off or make a call to the district and have them picked up.
And we continue to get tweets about charter schools. Here's another one. Corporate-owned charter schools are not public schools, period. Your thoughts?
Yeah, the definition of public is an interesting discussion. There are management companies that manage a number of charter schools, but the way we look at public schools is where is their public money and where is their public accountability, and both of those things are true in charter schools. Now, but I think there is a legitimate public debate as to what should the role of charters be in our community and in our state.
Let's take a few more calls for Trey Czar of the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. John on the West Side. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well, thanks.
I am calling to raise a point that has occurred to me many times over the years. My limited research, and I may be wrong, indicates that the District of Columbia has among the highest per pupil spending in the country and among the poorest per pupil performance in the country. And I'm wondering what, if any, kind of correlation can be drawn between expenditures and student performance.
It's a great question, John, and I think this is part of the challenge when we talk about school funding, is that funding is a necessary but not sufficient part of the equation. We look at districts. There are districts in our country that spend upwards of $22,000 a student per year and get very poor results. District of Columbia doesn't spend anywhere near that, but they have seen tremendous increases over the past few years. But we also see districts, Florida being among them across the state, that spend a lot less, and where funding becomes a real constraint on that next level of success.
Lots of emails about this topic. Scott emails the show, "We don't need to increase taxes for schools. Let's do an audit of the expenses and waste in education like we did with the police pension." The Richies email us, "We need new and more schools, but we are spending $43 million on redundant facilities. Let's prioritize before we raise taxes." Here's another email from Katie. "Talking about the graduation rate doesn't address the concerns of parents who are leaving for St. John's County. I know my child will graduate. The concern is whether he will get the best education. My oldest is in second grade in Duval Schools, and he's well ahead of the curriculum. His teacher just suggested he may need to skip a grade. Instead of giving us such stark and inferior choices, Duval Schools should demonstrate a commitment to the kids at the top of the spectrum by adopting the full-time gifted programming of St. John's County."
Yeah, and so I think there's a lot of great points that come up in there. I mean, I think specifically to the last one, there when we look at similar populations, demographically similar populations, kids in Duval County tend to do pretty much about as well as kids in St. John's County. Duval County obviously serves a much more diverse population in terms of income level and other areas.
And that can affect the gifted program.
Absolutely. It can affect everything. But certainly there are schools in Duval County that are magnet schools that have extensive gifted and talented programs. There's a lot of different options. And I think that parents really need to go in eyes wide open. And I think the issue is not whether St. John's County or Clay County or Duval County provide great education, but making sure that whatever education option someone chooses for their child is a good fit for that individual child.
What are your hopes with this survey data? What do you hope it will accomplish?
Yeah, we continue to do this year after year as a way to start and continue a public conversation. We believe very deeply that the public has to be involved in decisions that happen around its school system. So every year we have a big annual convening called the 1x1 Community Convention, which will be held January 23rd. We'd invite everybody to come out. These results will be discussed in detail. It's on a Saturday, and you can register at our website at jackspef.org. But I think this type of thing, this show, the media stories, the discussions that are happening on social media right now, that really is the goal, which is to provoke and continue a public conversation that leads into action.
Trezar, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate being here.
Trezar is president of the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. And much more still ahead later in the hour. First Coast Children's author Jennifer Swanson. Also, how the service dogs of Project Chance are helping children with autism in this area enjoy the holidays. But up next, it's the Influence 100. We'll tell you about the top 100 most influential people in Florida politics.
It's hard to be in two places at once, but our reporters are in hundreds of places right now.
For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in Accra.
I'm Matthew Bell in the Golan Heights.
I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you a global perspective on the news with a worldwide network of correspondents.
In Paris.
Morocco.
Cairo.
In Mexico City.
Join us here at The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
W-
WJCT and the Florida Theater present Wildcrest live on stage at the Florida Theater, February 15th at 1 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. Watch the Kratt brothers bring their creature adventure fun from the popular PBS Kids series to life on stage. Tickets available at floridatheater.com.
Welcome back. Well, a very hot list is out this week with just 100 names on it. The new issue of Influence Magazine has been published all around Florida, and inside its pages, a list of the 100 most influential people in Florida politics. Publisher Peter Schorsch is on the line now from the Tampa-St. Pete area with more about the Influence 100 list and who made the cut from our area. Peter Schorsch, thanks for calling into the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And full disclosure, I do some freelance work for your website, Florida Politics. We need to note that. So tell me a little bit about what inspired you to put this list together.
Well, people love lists. And it's the holidays, and people love arguing about lists. I mean, there's nothing better than arguing with your in-laws about who is the best quarterback or who has the best sandwich or what have you. So in the political world, we like to argue about, you know, who's got the most juice or not. And so I wanted to roll out a list that would get people talking. It looks like that happened on social media yesterday. And it's basically trying to establish a Fortune 500 list about Florida politics.
And these aren't people that hold office, mind you. These are people that have influence in other ways, correct?
That's right, because I mean, let's be honest, Rick Scott would definitely be number one on who's the most powerful person in Florida politics. And then it would be the state senators and congressmen. And that could be that would be a boring list. So we made a rule that you couldn't be running for office. So that knocked out Charlie Crist, or you couldn't be in office. And so that took out the mayors and all the state lawmakers and governor and et cetera. And so that really created a list where we categorized it. It was the players, basically the people that are political consultants and strategists, the lobbyists, the media, the business titans, the people that you know, that are big players in their community and they get involved in politics, like Norman Braman down in Jacksonville, down in Miami. And then we also included some legends, some people that have been a big part of the political process for the last 20 or so years that still have a lot of weight to throw around.
Sure. And as I looked through the list, there are some names that people in our corner of the state will recognize. Let's talk about the boldface names from Jacksonville and North Florida that made the list. Let's begin with the name Tom Petway. Why did you pick Tom Petway?
Well, he's just when you talk about who can raise huge sums of money for local candidates, statewide candidates, presidential candidates, from banker-rich Northeast Florida, Tom Petway is number one or two on everyone's list. He is a must-stop, a must-talk-to for congressional candidates, statewide candidates, people thinking even of running for president, just a enormous fundraiser. And there are a lot of people in the fundraising business, but he is one of the five or six Floridians who is an alpha among other alphas.
Also, John Rood on the list, former Ambassador John Rood.
Yeah, you know, John is a fun profile there. He's actually on the cover. You know, he's probably one of the most engaged power brokers, behind the scenes figures in Florida politics. He straddles both the Jacksonville area, which I know most of your listeners know how powerful he is there, but he's also very powerful in statewide politics. And has had a hand in almost every successful statewide Republican candidate. You know, again, he is a must stop, a must talk to for anybody thinking about running for statewide office.
And Florida Blue President Pat Garrity on the list. He hails from this area, a corporate guy.
Yeah, that was again. That's what I liked about this list is it wasn't just people. Automatically in the political process, there's somebody that if he and his company make a policy change, it has tremendous political ramifications for all of the stakeholders in the healthcare industry. He can shape the narrative of, you know, healthcare, Medicaid expansion, et cetera, has probably been the pressing issue of the legislature for the last year or so. He is the most prominent player in that sense on one of the most important issues. So he was almost an automatic, and it was kind of cool. His profile was written by one of his colleagues, Jason Altmaier, the former congressman from Pennsylvania, who now helps direct Florida Blue.
Another name on the list that you put in the legend category, UNF President John Delaney. Why Delaney?
You know, he is kind of a legend now, and I think he's reached that senior elder statesman status, even though he's really not that old or senior elder. But and I think we really saw this in the Jacksonville mayor's race. He's kind of the voice of reason, or a voice of reason, a voice of moderation. He's got an intellectual heft that speaks on a variety of issues. He's somebody, you know, if you're rolling out a major policy initiative locally or statewide, having him on that is a is an advantage. And the other thing about it is he's one of the few people, you know, he's got the policy credentials coming from a university president status, which speaks to a trend in Florida politics about politicians, former politicians, taking on these roles as university presidents. We've seen a lot of that over the last decade, and I'd say John best represents that.
And then the other local names, FSU President John Thrasher, Gary Chartrand, who heads the State Board of Education, and trial attorney Wayne Hogan. Have I missed anybody?
And an honorable mention for Marty Fiorentino of the Fiorentino Group, which is, I think, Jacksonville's largest lobbying firm, and it definitely represents the most Jacksonville interest in Tallahassee. So, yes, I think Northeast Florida was appropriately represented on the list.
And I know that you're probably getting lots of emails and calls about people who want to know why they didn't get on this list, right?
There's more complaining. I kid you not, we went live with the list at 4 o'clock in the morning yesterday. By 4:05, we had somebody who was an honorable mention wondering why they were not on the on the top 100. But there are a lot of great people over in Jacksonville that probably deserve recognition, people like Susie Wiles and all of the young staffers that are coming in the Curry administration. Brian Hughes, who's a Tallahassee guy who played a big role in Mayor Curry's run. Yeah, that's the problem with a list of 100. There's 2,900 other people who think they belonged on the list.
That's right. Well, it's fascinating reading, and we thank you for sharing it with us. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you. Take care, Melissa.
You too. He's publisher Peter Schorsch, and much more still to come on the program. Keep listening.
Tough times on Wall Street hit everybody, from investment bankers to the guy who sells them a slice of pizza every day for lunch.
Wall Street, that's the trend. It goes up, but it goes down, and it is getting slower and slower.
What isn't slowing down is our coverage of the news that matters. We'll tell you why the stocks swing and how to make sense of it on Marketplace, business news for the rest of us. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
Hi, I'm Evan Willman. I typically listen to the station when I'm in my my home office. I work out of my house a lot. I have my HD radio in there. So this is really the best of all worlds. It gives me my news. It gives me music that constantly delights and surprises me.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
Join us Sunday nights at 7 on 89.9 for classic old-time radio with music, mystery, comedy, and news. It's all at 7 o'clock Sunday nights, only on 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, she's the award-winning author of more than 20 nonfiction and fiction books for kids. Jennifer Swanson's How Things Work series by The Child's World were named to the 2012 book list Top 10 Books for Youth series for nonfiction. Swanson calls Jacksonville home, and she's having a big book signing event in town this week just in time for the holidays. She joins us now with a preview. Good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you've got a Brain Games right there with you. Very exciting.
Yes, that's the book that I'll be signing this weekend. I'm really excited about it. It's by National Geographic Kids.
Uh-huh.
And it's based on the National Geographic TV show of the same name. So if you've watched Brain Games on TV, we turned it into this really interactive, fun kids book.
You make this fun for kids. You get them excited about reading and learning, which is what every parent wants.
Exactly. For me, science, I'm also a science teacher, but for me, science is to be experienced. It's something that kids need to grab onto and get excited about now while they're young, so that when they get older and they're picking their college majors, maybe they'll go into science or engineering.
Absolutely. And how did you crack the code for this? Because it's much harder than it looks to write books that engage children.
It is. My secret is I try to think of something a kid would understand. For example, neuroscience, which is the Brain Games book, is really complex. But when you bring it down to a kid's size, for example, I have the kids put their two fists together. And I say, the brain is about the size of two fists. And you can see them go, oh.
Uh-huh.
And then another fun fact is, your thoughts travel as fast as the fastest race car, 260 miles per hour. So when you put it into their concepts, you could just literally see the lights going off in their brain going, oh, I get this. This is really cool.
You still think like a kid?
Yes. as a writer, there's kind of a saying in the writer's world that you write whatever age your brain is.
Uh-huh.
And mine is about 9 or 10. So I'm really good with like middle grade, fifth grade and up. That's what I think.
Now, the How Things Work series that you've written other books as well, of course, but that really got some incredible recognition. That had to have been exciting.
It was. And actually, that was the first set of books that I wrote. So it was even more exciting. But the concept behind that was really fun because we used a caveman and a robot to kind of offset what kind of concepts the kids would see. So they could see the contrast, and it took off and it did really, really well. We were so excited.
Are you in particular wanting girls to get engaged in science and technology?
Absolutely. I am so lucky that I was supported. I have three brothers, so I was supported my whole life, and I was told I could do whatever I wanted to do. So for me to go into science, it was no big deal. But I know that that's not always the case. So I am very much into promoting girls into science, technology, engineering. My daughter is studying engineering at Northwestern University.
And that's where I went to school.
Oh, that's a fabulous school, yeah. Other than the snow. She's adjusting to the snow.
Yeah, yeah, that's a big change. Sure. Well, it's so exciting that you also call this area home. There are a lot of nationally recognized authors that call this area home, and you're one of them.
Yeah, we've been in Jacksonville. My husband was in the Navy. Well, we both were, but he came here about 19 years ago, so we've been here longer than anywhere else. So we love Jacksonville. It's a great place to live.
Brain Games, according to the New York Journal of Books, is over 100 pages of fun. It offers clever brain challenges, activities designed to give the brain a much-needed break, and even explains how the Rubik's Cube can improve your life. The pictures are vibrant and detailed, leaving nothing to the imagination. And I hope you'll sign this for my daughters.
I would be happy to.
If that would be possible.
Absolutely.
My younger daughter in particular loves the Project MC Squared series on Netflix, because those are girls that get into science and math.
That's fantastic.
And what you're doing is similar. You're making science exciting and accessible for kids, especially girls.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is wonderful. And so if you've never met Jennifer, you have the opportunity to bring your children and just in time for Christmas or Hanukkah or the holiday that you celebrate, buy one of her books because you're having an event on Saturday.
I am. I will be at the Barnes & Noble off San Jose Boulevard from 1 to 3 p.m. I will actually be giving a little talk. So if you want to come and do some interactive things and do some brain games and brain teasers, stop by. And it's Teacher Appreciation Day, so we would love to have all the teachers.
Where do you
come
teach,
out.
By the way?
I actually teach online. I teach for Johns Hopkins University for their Center for Talented Youth.
Excellent.
So I have students all over the world. I teach middle school science.
And you'll go. And when you're doing the brain teasers at the Barnes & Noble, what do they involve?
Well, we in this book, just like on the TV show, we have kids stand up, stand on one foot, spin around. We show them pictures and make their brains think, and then we tell them why their brain is behaving that way. So it's really fun. You kind of learn even though you don't know you're learning.
It's going to be a fun event, and I bet there will be quite a crowd too to see Jennifer Swanson this Saturday at the Barnes & Noble on San Jose Boulevard from 1 to 5. She is the author of the How Things Work series, Brain Games, and many more. Take your kids. Don't miss this opportunity. It's going to be a blast.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Thank you, Jennifer Swanson. Mm-hmm. A pleasure. And we're back in a moment.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question. Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great that's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Spend some time in the square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market invite you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/the square.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica, only on 89.9 FM After Hours.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it's the time of year when many of us take our kids out and about, maybe holiday shopping. But if your child is on the autism spectrum, the stimulation of all the colors, bustle, lights, sound, that can often be an overwhelming sensory overload and sometimes very traumatic. The local HEAL Foundation, that's Healing Every Autistic Life, has a success story to share when it comes to this type of issue. They use service dogs to calm kids on the autism spectrum as a form of therapy, and the results can be quite incredible. Leslie Weed, co-founder of the HEAL Foundation, joins us, along with BJ and KCJ Swajinski. They are the president and executive director of Project Chance, administering the Autism Service Dog Program, and they have brought Maka with them. She is an absolutely beautiful dog. Good morning, ladies. Thanks for being
Good
with
morning.
Us.
Good morning. Thanks for
Hi.
Having us. BJ, let's begin with you. We think of service dogs as helping those who are of low vision, usually, not people with autism. This is really an incredible idea.
Yes, this came about because I was a special ed teacher for years, and I was always a dog trainer. And I decided that as I got through wanting to get more involved with the community, I was able to bring my dogs to schools with me when I was teaching. And I was teaching kids who had psychiatric problems, and that was in Pennsylvania. And when I moved up here, I wanted to focus on a younger group doing early intervention. So when I did Project Chance, I started working with lower age kids, so I can start out helping as other families have to work with the therapies and do early intervention. And then now we've grown in a relationship with HEAL, and it's working out quite well.
Leslie Weed, this is one example of HEAL's work on the First Coast, and it's exciting to see the results.
Yes, I'm a true believer. I also have, my daughter has a service dog, Macon, and HEAL was recently entrusted with an endowment and a grant from Eleanor Blanchard through the Community Foundation, and this grant was specific to the autism service dogs. So I immediately seeked Project Chance. They have gone beyond the call of duty. And this year, since the endowment was $750,000. We will be having dogs forever and ever. But they have since produced 17 dogs since last summer that have been paired up with families. And it's a great partnership, and they've done a fabulous job. And the story's coming out of these families, these kids.
KCJ, can you share a few of the stories with our listeners, how these dogs and the children, how they bond and the types of changes that families see?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that one of our families, Zach, and his dog Bunker, can now, they go out into public all the time, and they go to places that were really overstimulating before. Some of these families never went to the places that you go every day, to Publix, to Target. And now the families can go out, and there's lowered stress. The families, the parents don't feel anxiety, so therefore the kids don't feel anxiety. So they have normal days. The kids sleep through the night. Some of these kids would never sleep through the night, and they would have tantrums. And now there's a lot of peace in the family. Anything else?
A real breakthrough. And so, BJ, how does an autism assistance dog differ from a guide dog, say?
We are real results-based, and we are real behavior changers. So this is not a feel-good thing. The feel-good thing happens because of the results that we do with the dogs. So when I pair up a dog with a family, what I'm looking for are families that want to have their kids get involved in their schools to change the kids to be workers and producers when they get out of school. So we do a lot of life skills and social skill intervention so that these kids will become citizens of great value, whether they become workers, college kids, vo-tech school certified students. We want these kids to be understanding that they will use their dogs. They become leaders of what the dog's needs are. So part of their part in raising these dogs is that they must weekly or bi-weekly interact with their dogs and learn from very early on how to handle their dogs, what their needs are to feed, to train, to speak with these dogs. So we increase their speaking capacity, we increase their cognitive skills, we increase their motor skills because they are the leaders of their dogs. So we want them to not just have what the dog gives back to them, but how they can make their dogs as part of their therapy to get these kids, to get themselves to be leaders in their world.
Leslie Weed, it is incredible to realize that just the presence of the dog can link a child with autism and ground the child with autism so powerfully. Ground the child, calm mm-hmm. the child, and link the child to others.
Yeah, we recently did an outing at the mall, which is a very chaotic place. And there were several dogs and their parents. But it was so amazing to watch these children by themselves lead this their dogs through this crowd, and their mother isn't having to hold on to their arm or keep them in the car and not bring them to the mall. But it was a great thing to see. In the mall, it kind of parted like the Red Sea, and people were seeing these kids with disabilities. One thing I noticed is that when I brought my daughter in public with the dog, people became very warming about her condition. Typically, I'd get the stares, and they'd turn around, and, you know, I'd feel the comments. But when I showed up with Macon, they'd say to their children, look at that dog helping that young child. So it helped. I wasn't expecting that. And that was that's really helpful to the family to be accepted through the dog in public.
We had two of our we had two of the families get together and head to Disney, which was really exciting because not only were the kids and the families able to have this social outing, but they did it together and they were normal kids and they
were able to really enjoy it. The phones are ringing about this. We're almost out of time, so if you're listening and want more information, maybe even want to acquire a dog for your own child, just go to this website. ProjectChance.com, ProjectChance.com. Assistance Dogs for Children with Autism, an incredible story helped in part through a grant from the local HEAL Foundation that is healing every autistic life. Leslie Weed is the co-founder of the HEAL Foundation. The Swedinsky family also with us this morning. And thank you all so much for sharing this incredible story. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And that's our program. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch, and the show theme, composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Diane Reams up next as Chicago's mayor fires the city's police chief amid protests over the response to the killing of a black teenager. An update on efforts to boost public trust in police forces nationwide. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.